From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. If you think that Auburn, which is led by embattled quarterback Cam Newton, is the only college football team with problems this year, then you haven't been following UNC football. Ahead in Only a Game, a recap of the Tar Heels' missteps and disappointments. Also, Olympian Cullen Jones pool storms the nation to promote swimming to minority communities. And also ahead, a conversation with the authors of Everything You Know Is Pong.
The rise of the great American suburb in the 1950s, China's unstoppable rise, Atari, and their invention of the video games without which our lives would be meaningless. Ping pong was at the center of them all.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. You may not give a fig about Cam Newton. That's okay. We're going to talk about the Heisman favorite anyway, because Alabama-Auburn is a game of some import. It's time for college football. That's Dan Wetzel's favorite sport, which is why Dan Wetzel of Yahoo Sports joins me now. Dan, welcome back to the program.
Bill, thank you for having me on.
In yesterday's Iron Bowl, Alabama won the first half. Auburn won the second half. Unfortunately for Alabama, only one team could win the game, which Auburn did 28-27. Too bad for Alabama, huh?
Well, Alabama has no one to blame but themselves. They had numerous chances for touchdowns that they fumbled the ball away, turnovers. They should have been up, you know, probably 35 points in the first half. So, if not more. And so then they really did nothing in the second half. Auburn made great adjustments at halftime, and they got the best player in the country in Cam Newton. And when it's time for plays that just win you games or fourth and inches, he just needs to get the inches, he's going to do it. Just such a remarkable talent. And so Alabama just shot itself in the foot, and Auburn took advantage of it.
The news has been relatively quiet this week in the Cam Newton investigation. Does this mean there's less interest in the possibility that Newton's camp may have violated NCAA rules and that Newton will snicker his way to the awarding of the Heisman Trophy on December 11th?
I think he will win the trophy, yes, but at any point the NCAA could come up with enough of a development to rule him ineligible. It's a semi-complicated case, but it basically comes down to the idea that did Cam Newton know his father was trying to get money for him to sign at a university? It's fairly well established for, I think, most people. We have no proof that he got anything to go to Auburn. We just know he didn't go to Mississippi State. But the question mark and the burden of proof that seems to be the case here is Auburn saying, well, if Cam didn't know what his father was doing, he should still be eligible. That's a temporary solution. That may not last when you get to a full NCAA investigation, which I think would probably happen over the next year. But in the short term, Cam Newton's still playing. In the long term, I think what you're seeing are victories and maybe Heisman trophies that could be temporary in nature.
On Wednesday, Ohio State President Gordon G. characterized this season's opponents of number 3 Texas Christian and number 4 Boise State as, quote, little sisters of the poor. Does Boise State's loss to number 19 Nevada last night bolster the argument that it plays a weaker schedule than teams like the number 8 Buckeyes?
It really doesn't. I mean, it's a loss, but it was a loss to the number 19th ranked team in the country, Nevada, on the road. The real issue is Gordon G. has absolutely no idea what he's talking about when it comes to college football, which he sort of admits. He doesn't know how the BCS formula works. He doesn't know how a playoff would work. What he was really arguing was that the BCS formula doesn't work because the BCS is on the verge or could very easily put either TCU or Boise State into the title game. He's saying that any system that does that is illegitimate. So by his, quote, defense of the BCS, he's actually undermining it. That's the real issue here. It's not whether or not Boise State plays a tough enough schedule. It's that the people in charge of college football don't understand college football. And that's to the eternal frustration of the players, the coaches, and the fans that invest so much time and do understand the sport.
Dan, does it strike you as somewhat humorous that things are relatively quiet concerning the nation's number one team, Oregon?
Well, they haven't played any real major games or clashes that would do this. Again, it's kind of the problem with the BCS. You have this just complete disparate schedules. And so Oregon scores a lot of points. They're a very, very good football team, but we just have no idea. They're able to cruise along without playing any of the other contenders, and it's the same thing on the other teams. And then at the end, you're just supposed to guess. We think they're really good. We don't know. We'll see. I mean, they are good, but are they the one of the two best? You know, no sport in the world would do this. The Price is Right has a better system of determining a champion than college football.
Why isn't anybody talking about number six Stanford? Is that is the football cardinal overshadowed by the women's basketball cardinal?
They were essentially eliminated because they lost at Oregon, and nobody cares. They have a real likelihood of not even playing in one of the major bowl games, not because they're not a good enough team. Bowl directors do not like Stanford because they do not have a massive traveling fan base. They very well could be left out of a major bowl game because they don't have enough fans. They have probably the number one pick in the draft in Andrew Luck. They have a tremendous coach. It's one of the best stories. They don't have enough traveling fans. That's the ridiculous of the system.
On Thursday, Texas A&M defeated Texas, ensuring the Longhorns' first losing season since 1997. This is the team that went to the BCS title game last January. I would suggest that football is dying in the Lone Star State, except that, oops, Texas A&M is in Texas, too, or at least I think it is. What's up in Austin?
Yeah, TCU also. Yeah, terrible season by Texas. Recruits no longer stockpile up at great programs. There used to be a time when a very good player in Texas would go to Texas and wait three years and hope to be a senior starter. Nowadays, those kids look for playing time immediately. It spreads out the talent. So what you're looking at in these top five, six teams in the country, none of those are to the traditional powers. And then you're seeing teams like Alabama and Texas falling apart, USC, Notre Dame, Penn State, different teams at Michigan, things like that. So it's a different era in college football. Kids, everyone's on TV. They want to play right away.
Which of today's college football matchups will you be paying particular attention to?
I think there's two that are interesting. One is the LSU-Arkansas game is certainly probably the best game, number 5 versus number 12. And LSU's always an entertaining team, and but there isn't a whole lot at stake there. I think the other game that's interesting for other reason is Ohio State and Michigan in Columbus. If Ohio State blows out Michigan, as most people predict, the question is whether or not Michigan will fire Rich Rodriguez, their coach, and would they get Stanford's coach, Jim Harbaugh, to come in. This could be the last call for Michigan coach Rich Rodriguez. So there's something at stake there. Other than that, there's not a whole lot on the slate that has really anything to pertain to the national title.
Dan Wetzel is Yahoo Sports national columnist and the co-author of Death to the BCS, published by Gotham. Dan, thanks very much.
Thanks, Bill.
Today, North Carolina takes on Duke in Durham, and if you think Auburn has had a weird season, consider the Tar Heels. When the season began, UNC football was ranked in the top 20, and they were picked by some to play in a BCS bowl game. But allegations of agent payoffs and academic fraud have led to the suspension of more than a dozen players, 7 of whom missed the entire season. North Carolina Public Radio's Dave DeWitt has the story.
The first football game in Chapel Hill is usually just a pleasant diversion, something to tide fans over until Midnight Madness kicks off the basketball season. But this year was different. A highly ranked defense, a veteran quarterback, and a date with LSU in the kickoff classic had pushed Tar Heel hoops off the front pages. And then, at the height of anticipation, all that excitement evaporated in an instant.
To everyone who loves this university, I'm sorry about what I have to tell you. During the course of the joint investigation by the NCAA and the university into possible agent violations, we learned of a situation that includes possible academic misconduct involving a former undergraduate tutor and student athletes on the football team.
UNC Chancellor Holden Thorpe delivered the bad news at a hastily called press conference just 6 days before the season opener. Sitting in his off-campus apartment, quarterback T.J. Yates watched that press conference on TV and wondered if his senior year was over before it even began.
You know, the players didn't know, the coaches didn't know, the guys that were even involved didn't didn't even know until the last second whether or not they were getting on that bus to go to the game.
13 of them would not, including 8 starters on that heralded defense. Still, North Carolina made it a game against the Tigers, losing only when tight end Zach Pianalto couldn't haul in a last-second pass in the end zone. The next few weeks were a blur. Associate head coach John Blake resigned when it came to light he was deeply connected to an agent. Players were dismissed and suspended, while others were reinstated. Daily headlines in the local and national media turned it all into a public relations nightmare. Chancellor Holden Thorpe.
I think what has happened here is that the excitement of potentially being able to play pro football and the difficulties associated with balancing academic success and social success and time put into football was challenging for a group of young men, and we didn't pick up on the challenges that they were having soon enough.
Playing without most of their best players, Carolina lost again in week 2. But then came a streak of 5 wins in 6 games, all leading up to a cool night in Tallahassee when luck turned North Carolina's way.
The snap, the kick, high enough, long enough, it's no good! Carolina wins! It is no good! And the stadium is stunned.
And with that missed kick by Florida State, the Tar Heels had somehow become bowl eligible. Moments later, head coach Butch Davis stood in the middle of the field beaming with pride.
It just, you know, I mean, the resilience of these kids. I mean, you coach football because you love kids, and you coach them because you in good times and in tough times, and you love to see their will and their belief in each other to just stand up against all the odds and the adversity and hang in there, and they'll remember these things for the rest of their life. That's what college football and that's what college sports teaches kids. Butch, congratulations to you.
When the scandal broke, most people believed Davis's days were numbered. His associate head coach is at the center of the allegations involving agents, and a tutor Davis hired to help his own high school son was involved in the academic fraud. But Chancellor Thorpe says the actions taken by Davis, athletic director Dick Bedore, and himself have proven that academic reputation trumps football glory.
So with the three of us all having demonstrated our commitment to that, then there's absolutely no reason why you'd want to change the group of people that are doing that.
Davis may return next season, but senior T.J. Yates won't. Yates was lightly recruited coming out of high school and ended up starting for 4 seasons at quarterback. It's the last year, he says, he'll remember most.
You know, I challenge any other team in the country to go through what we went through as far as losing players, and then on top of that having injuries with the players we had left, and how we deal with it as a team and how we overcame everything, how we persevered throughout the season through the individual games with, you know, with all the challenges that we had that were put on us is, you know, I think it's something remarkable.
Yates' last game won't be in the Orange Bowl or the Fiesta Bowl. Most likely, he'll take his last college snap in the Meineke Car Care Bowl or the Franklin American Mortgage Music City Bowl. After a year like this, he'll take it. For Only a Game, I'm Dave DeWitt in Chapel Hill.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. The unsuccessful men's volleyball teams competing at the Asian Games in China did not lack for excuses. Coco Prisetyo, who plays for Indonesia, said, "The sunlight affected my performance." Does it seem odd to anyone else that a beach volleyball player was unprepared for sunlight? Members of the team from Yemen maintained that the Chinese cheerleaders dressed in bikinis, quote, had something to do with our losing the match. The problem, apparently, was that the cheerleaders, whom the Chinese press described as, quote, sexy, were simply too beautiful.
Distractions, like butterflies are buzzing round my head. When I'm alone, I think of you and the life we'd lead if we could only be free from these distractions.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Olympian Cullen Jones aims to save lives on his multi-city pool storming tour. But first, here to discuss all things NFL, including the banishment of Thor, Odin, Chili, and Favre to the Viking netherworld, is CBS Sports national columnist Greg Doyle. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Bill. I love the word Odin. It kind of gives me chills. He freaks me out, Odin.
Well, let's start with the Minnesota Vikings. On Monday, they fired their embattled head coach, Brad Childress. Is it fair that he was the fall guy in this?
Oh, absolutely. Childress created a culture where Favre was kind of treated one way. He was the star quarterback, and everybody else was treated another way. Case in point, two training camps in a row Favre didn't have to go to. And players don't get upset about stuff like this when the team is winning.
Mm-hmm.
But when the team is 3-7 and the media is pointing fingers and the fans are booing, and then they realize, wait a minute, that 41-year-old joker quarterback is the same guy that skipped training camp 2 years in a row. Then they start getting mad, they start pitching a fit, and now you see a team being 3-7. So anyway, Childress didn't cause the players to act like babies, but he set up an environment where they could, and they did.
All right, I hate to bring this question up again, but Brett Favre has announced that he will retire after this season. Can we take him at his word this time, please?
Well, I think we have no choice now because he's so darn awful. I don't know who would want him next year. Completely serious. He's not the kind of guy you want to have on your team as a backup because clearly the chemistry issues and the off-the-field hassles are not worth it unless he's going to be throwing for 4,000 yards. He's not that guy anymore. So I think he might retire simply because no one will take him. But I also think this whole Jen Sterger story, I think he probably has realized, you know what, I need to go home and I need to stay home.
There were three, count them, three NFL games on Thanksgiving Day. Did any of them have you looking up from the stuffing and cranberry sauce?
Yeah, only one of them, and that's because I'm a bad guy. I have a John Kitna rule where if he is playing quarterback for you, I'm not watching you, and that's the Dallas Cowboys. So I didn't watch that game. And my Kitna rule also extends to if he used to be your franchise quarterback, you're lousy, I'm not watching you either. So Detroit Lions, they're out.
Mm-hmm.
Which leads us to the Bengals at night. And Kitna did used to play for the Bengals, but I've also got a Schadenfreude rule, whatever that word is, that says basically I like to revel in the Bengals' misery. And so I watched that, and I reveled for a good 3 hours.
They are dependable in that respect, aren't they?
Yeah, and I don't know if you realize this, but I live in Cincinnati, so I've been reveling for several years. And I love the fact that, you know, who would have thought that Terrell Owens and Chad Ochocinco and Pac-Man Jones and Tank Johnson, who would have thought a team with such stalwarts in the locker room would just fold at the first sign of trouble?
Isn't it about time that the National Football League gives Detroit and Dallas a holiday off and gets some, I don't know, some good teams to play on Thanksgiving?
Yeah, you know, Dallas is a team that, for my generation and older ones too, we grew up watching the Cowboys because there was no cable back then. So the Cowboys were on NBC or whoever had the NFL back then every week. And so we haven't died off yet. And so as long as people like me are still alive, the Cowboys will still be playing on Thanksgiving and still get pretty good ratings, I guess. The Detroit Lions, though, I can't make sense of that one. Maybe you can tell me why. There's not a single reason in the world for the worst franchise in the NFL over the course of 50 years to keep playing on that marquee day. I can't get it.
I can only fall back on Fiddler on the Roof. Tradition.
Yeah, well, Fiddler on the Roof, if you put that guy quarterback for the Lions, I might watch the game. John Kitna, not so much.
Actually, Dallas has shown some improvement despite Thursday's loss under interim head coach Jason Garrett. Does he deserve to have the word interim stricken from the title?
I think he might, and not just because, well, an interim coach came in, there's a different voice, and they've won a couple, and they really should have won Thursday, so they should be 3-0 under Garrett. And that would be a knee-jerk reaction to say that's enough reason to give him the job. Truth is, he was a rising star for several years, offensive coordinator, and had a couple of chances to go elsewhere. He could have been the Ravens head coach, not John Harbaugh, for example, and he chose to stay. So he's a guy that people have believed would be a really good head coach if given the chance, and now he's proving it. Now, they need to play out the rest of the season and still play hard for him, but Wade Phillips did not get that team to play hard for him. It was pretty obvious. He's a very nice guy, but not a very good head football coach. Garrett might be both.
Greg, when we last talked, it seemed that every NFL team was either 4-3 or 3-4. Which teams have begun to separate themselves from the pack since then?
Well, I'm a glasses half full kind of guy, so let me say right off the bat, Detroit and Carolina and the Bengals have combined for about 0 wins since we spoke last, and they're all about 2-8 on average, and so they've separated themselves. There's no mediocrity in those cities. How about that? On the bright side, the Jets and the Patriots are both 9-2, and they both won 3 or 4 games in a row, and they are running away with the AFC East. They're running away with the AFC's top 2 seeds. And then you've got the Philadelphia Eagles are also running away in that conference. They're only 7-3. Doesn't look like they're that good because, look, Tampa Bay's 7-3, and Tampa Bay's not very good at all. But the Eagles are 7-3, and they're 3-0 since Michael Vick replaced Kevin Cobb at quarterback. So that's probably the 3 best teams in the NFL are the Jets, Patriots, and Eagles.
Greg Doyle is a national columnist for CBSSports.com, and he joins me on Only a Game from time to time to talk pro football. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you, Bill, so much.
In these days after Thanksgiving, more American families are considering whether they'll go ice skating this winter than are wondering where they stored their swim caps. But in this time of family togetherness, consider this. Is your family a swimming family or a non-swimming family? Statistics say children from non-swimming families are 8 times more likely to be at risk for drowning, and nearly 6 out of 10 African-American and Latino children don't know how to swim. But even as the temperatures dip, USA Swimming is trying to change those numbers. Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
You go up or I have my hand down. It's either up or down. If you're wrong, you have to sit down. Last person standing comes up here, okay? Teachers, I need your help. We don't want any cheaters, okay? Everybody, stand up.
Rowdy Games gets the kids of PS3, an elementary school in New York's Greenwich Village, on their feet for a game of true or false. He says women didn't compete in the first modern Olympic Games in 1896. If the kids think that statement is true, they raise their hand. If they think it's false...
Everybody with their hand down, sit down!
Rowdy's job is to get the kids excited about the main event, a chat about the importance of learning to swim with Cullen Jones, who won an Olympic gold medal with the men's freestyle relay team at the Beijing Olympics. Rowdy Gaines won 3 gold medals at the 84 Games and is an Olympic swimming commentator for NBC. But he jokes that nobody wants to listen to an old man speak. And there's another reason why he's not the perfect spokesperson for USA Swimming's Make a Splash campaign. Gaines comes from a swimming family.
I learned how to swim before I learned how to walk. I was 9 months old.
Cullen Jones, on the other hand, comes from a non-swimming family. And his story is every non-swimming parent's nightmare. When he was 5, Cullen found himself upside down at the bottom of a large water park slide. His father, Ronald, had told him not to let go of the inner tube, but he hadn't told him what to do if the inner tube flipped over in the water. His mother, Deborah, came down the slide behind him, but couldn't do anything to help. She didn't know how to swim. A lifeguard rescued Cullen and performed mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Within the week, Deborah Jones had enrolled her only child in swimming lessons. It's a scary story to tell kids who aren't sure they want to get in the water, but Rowdy Gaines says it's exactly what they need to hear.
It's important for 2 reasons. One, because the kids can see that person and say, wow, if that happened to him, then, you know, I don't feel so bad anymore. And second, he's African American. He's black. You know, that's probably the most important thing, especially in the communities that we're trying to reach out to.
Everybody give it up for Cullen Jones!
Standing 6'5" and wearing the shiniest pair of Nikes these kids have ever seen, Cullen Jones doesn't look like he was ever a tiny kid who almost drowned at a Pennsylvania water park. So it's time for one last game with the kids of PS3.
Now, true or false, when I was 5 years old, I almost drowned. How many of you guys think that's true? I swim for a living, this is my job. If you have your hands up, you're right, I almost drowned.
Yay, we have a crowd, yeah.
Since 2007, USA Swimming has been providing low-cost or no-cost lessons to kids in 43 states. But Cullen knows that the reasons why minority kids don't learn to swim run way deeper than the cost of swimming lessons. Fear, like the fear his mother felt when she watched a lifeguard save her son, is a much bigger factor. And studies have shown that worries about dry skin and skimpy bathing suits are also a problem. Cullen tries to address all those issues with the kids.
For me, it was hard growing up. Do you guys know what swimmers usually wear at practice?
Down the street at the Chelsea Recreation Center, 5 kids have been chosen for a private lesson with an Olympian.
All right, everybody slide in. Come on.
Come on.
Feel my pain.
The water's not cold. Someone tells me the thermostat is set at 80 degrees. But for Nicholas, Lindsay, Drew, Julietta, and Sophia, there might as well be ice cubes floating between the lane lines. Cullen Jones coaxes his swimmers into the water and starts breaking down their freestyle, the stroke for which he holds the 50-meter American record. Adrian Benepi, commissioner for the New York City Department of Parks and Recreation, looks on. In the past, Benepi says, the city had trouble finding lifeguards because too many New York teenagers and adults didn't know how to swim. Benepi would like to change that.
We place a great emphasis now on kids learning how to read and write and do math, but swimming should go in with that because it's one of the few things you'll learn that will save your life.
The New York Parks Department is currently reaching 25,000 to 27,000 second graders every year with waterproofing programs, lessons designed not to create Olympic swimmers, but to teach kids to swim well enough to save themselves from drowning. But Benepi says he'd like to see the program expanded to all 70,000 second graders in the New York public schools.
Who wants to be on Cohen's team? Oh, for crying out loud. He's really...
After about a half hour of instruction from Cohen, Rowdy Gaines leans over from the next lane and challenges the swimmers to a relay.
Judges and timers ready. Quiet for the start, please. Swimmers, take your mark. Go!
By design, the two teams are relatively well matched, setting up a splashy and exciting final lap between Rowdy Gaines and Cohen Jones. The kids squeal and cheer and shout, but in the end, no one will tell them who won. New York City is the Make-A-Splash team's sixth and final stop on the 2010 tour. This year, Cohen spoke with kids in Omaha, Chicago, Los Angeles, Oakland, and Shreveport, Louisiana. After he's gotten a chance to dry off from his latest adventure, Cohen Jones says racing a relay with kids from the program is a rare treat.
I was in Shreveport, Louisiana 2 weeks ago. I think it was like two girls that knew how to swim. Everyone else, deathly afraid of the pool. But at the end of that lesson, I had all of them underwater, all of them, you know, comfortable doing it.
Growing up, Cohen knew that he had picked a sport overwhelmingly populated by whites. As a kid, he didn't always own up to the fact that he wore Speedos on the weekends. And as a teenager, it wasn't uncommon for him to be the only black person in the building when he trained with his team. But what Cohen didn't know until a friend slipped him some literature from the Make-A-Splash program was that black children are nearly three times more likely to die from drowning as white children.
And as soon as I found that out, I was just like, wow, this is awful. Like, how do I change this? How can I help? I mean, looking at my own family, I understand that the statistics are real. I mean, there are people in my family that don't know how to swim, that considered my career, oh, you're still doing that swimming thing? And, you know, now that I've been successful in it, now it's like, hey, swimming, are you training? Cohen, you can't eat that. You can't, you know, it's completely different now.
For Cohen Jones, swimming became much more than a matter of survival. It took him to North Carolina State, where he swam on scholarship. When he turned pro, swimming brought Cohen a seven-year, $2 million endorsement deal from Nike. Is it any wonder that when standing in front of kids thinking about learning to swim, Cohen Jones takes off his surprisingly shiny Nike shoes and tells the kids that he got them for free? With all the things swimming has brought him, Cohen has yet to win an individual Olympic gold medal. He hopes to do that in London in 2012. Cohen admits that it's a selfish goal, but he hopes that it will also make more people listen when he lectures, fundraises, and lobbies for programs that teach minority kids to swim. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Gibbon.
You're listening to Only a Game. Rainey Frick lives in Kalispell, Montana, and after hearing last week's program, she wrote as follows, "I'm not really a sports fan and find myself listening to your program mainly because it just comes on next." Not perhaps an entirely auspicious beginning, but Ms. Frick goes on to say, "I have to admit I loved the program this morning. Not so much the stuff about football and women's basketball, but I loved the Titanic Thompson story. Fantastic job." Regarding the show from the morning of November 6th, Jane Lowell, who hears Only a Game on KWMU in St. Louis, was not so laudatory. I waited 40 minutes to hear about the Giants' victory. Your acknowledgement of it lasted less than 10 seconds. You spent more time on the Rangers and the Cowboys. Is this because they are a West Coast team, or do you just hate the Giants? I don't know how old you are, Ms. Lowell, but my guess is that I was rooting for the Giants of Willie Mays, Whitey Lockman, Don Mueller, Mike McCormick, and Alvin Dark, not to mention the Giants of Willie Mays, Willie McCovey, Orlando Cepeda, and Juan Marichal before you were born. I don't follow the current Giants as closely as I did those heroes of yore, but I certainly don't hate them. By November 6th, the Giants and you had had 5 nights to celebrate their triumph. We gave their achievement the additional attention we thought appropriate. During that November 6th show, in connection with silly speculation that Ashton Kutcher and Demi Moore might be implicated in a potential recruiting scandal involving Iowa football, Charlie Pierce and I wondered together why else Ashton Kutcher and Demi Moore might have been in the middle of the country. Larry Smith, who hears the program on WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts, wrote to let us know that Mr. Kutcher was born in Iowa. As the Mickey Rooney character in Requiem for a Heavyweight used to say, that's good to know, very good to know. And finally, old friend, Bruins fan George Carter, who coaches midgets, mites, squirts, and amoebas down Carver there, called with some good hockey talk.
I know the Cup's coming back because the Cup is time for it to come back. It's looking for its home. It's been all over the place for the last 38 years, and it's been crying. Why am I coming to Boston? When am I coming back to Boston? My God, I miss Boston. Oh, geez, why don't they sign players who'll get me back to where I belong?
Like George, you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can also reach us through the website, and you can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at Nuance.com. This is NPR.
7 years ago, Wayne and Lori Hallquist, both of whom are quite tall, became man and wife. Recently, it occurred to them that at a combined height of 13 feet 4 inches, they might be taller than any other married couple. At a ceremony in Stockton, California last Thursday, just barely under the marquee at the Hollywood Museum, Guinness World Records certified that distinction. Lori Hallquist, who stands 6 feet 5.95 inches, said, "We can find each other quite easily in a crowd." Her husband, 6 feet 10.4 inches and apparently also a card, joked, "We can see people going bald who might not know it." Unfortunately, there's not room here for all the other funny things the two very tall people said. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, ping, pong, ping, pong. It may seem meaningless, but two authors will argue otherwise. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
It may very well seem meaningless.
Well, you just listen and you'll see. I guess we'd better enjoy this pro basketball season, Charlie, because Billy Hunter, the head of the NBA Players Association, said this week that he is 99% sure there will be a lockout next summer. You agree with his math?
I agree with his political sensibility, where he points out that the owners are not budging on anything, including demands for cuts in salaries, contract lengths, guarantees, annual raises, and the rookie salary scale. If the other side is not negotiating, you wind up with a lockout. But I would point out, Bill, that the NFL may be careering toward a lockout itself, which means soccer's big opportunity may be here in the United States of America. No sports of any kind.
A bright side to every story, I guess. President Obama spoke of patience this week, but he was not talking about the economic recovery or any of the other major issues that this country is facing. For what, pray tell, does our commander-in-chief wish us to wait patiently?
Well, he wants us to be patient on the Miami Heat. Why he's even discussing this at this point, I don't have any idea. But I'll tell you one thing. If he really did say this, as quoted in the Associated Press, it takes some time for the team to come together. There's no I in team. If he really said there's no I in team, can you impeach a president for talking like the worst sports writer in America? Because that's about where he is right now. Well, that's awful.
I can think of numbers of presidents who would have fallen and, if that were the case.
And there's no G in stupid.
Meanwhile, in Cleveland, basketball fans are being warned to choose their wardrobes very carefully for LeBron's first game against the Cavaliers on December 2nd. Those fans wearing clothing that is considered crude or offensive to Mr. James or his family will be asked to remove that clothing. Isn't that sort of like saying to fans, come on, I dare you?
I don't know. I mean, if there's some fines involved, maybe they're just trying to find a way to raise a little money. I like the senior vice president of communications attitude, who says, we don't want to create a police state. Good. You have to set the bar somewhere. Okay. I would think that they would be able to make a policy where they only arouse people wearing the obscenities. But, you know, you stink, you quitter. We don't
You're
like
out
you,
of here.
You bum. Come on. Yeah. That's an American sports tradition.
Duquesne University has self-reported a possible rules violation to the NCAA. The school sent basketball gear to U.S. troops overseas via a junior college coach, which is apparently some sort of secondary rules violation. I wonder if maybe the NCAA might look the other way in this one instance.
I will bet you almost as much money as you have in your pocket that the NCAA doesn't look the other way. This is exactly the kind of stupid thing they like to make a statement on. If I was Duquesne University, I'd send shoes for the rest of the year and dare them to put me on probation.
I learned this week that a basketball player at IPFW has been wearing a boxing helmet when he plays after suffering 4 concussions during his sophomore season. Given all the news about post-concussion syndrome, I wonder if this becomes a trend.
I mean, it's an interesting innovation. It makes me wonder, I mean, from a purely basketball sense, it makes me wonder if John Peckinpah, the forward from IPFW, Indiana University, Purdue University, Fort Wayne, by the way, if you're keeping score at home of initials, and you should be, I wonder about his peripheral vision. I've never boxed, so I don't know.
I'd say it would be a real problem. Yeah. But, you know, they tell me football players wear helmets, and yet they get
concussions, right. But, I mean, at least this is an attempt.
Thanksgiving Day football games, Charlie. A traditional time of togetherness when families gather to watch grown men trying to intentionally break each other's arms. Wait a minute. That can't be right, can it?
Yeah. Sean Hill, the quarterback of the Detroit Lions, has accused the New England Patriots of trying to re-break his left forearm when he ran a quarterback sneak on 4th-and-1 from the New England 2 the other day. He claimed that he was down in the pile, apparently, and some guy was literally down, as he says, quote, literally down there trying to break my arm, which is already broken. Literally trying. I guess that wasn't seen by the officials. I guess it wasn't.
Meanwhile, the feud in Tennessee between Titans quarterback Vince Young and coach Jeff Fisher continues. Apparently, Young tried to apologize for his unruly behavior after being injured and benched last Sunday, but Fisher is not accepting that apology. Why not?
Because he texted it, and I don't blame Jeff Fisher on this one. Talk to me face-to-face. Call me on the telephone. As he points out, anybody could text.
He's a young guy. You know, texting is kind of his milieu.
Yeah, but why should anyone assume that it was actually Vince Young doing the texting?
Could have been Brett Favre. It is the season for baseball players to change teams, or at least to explore the possibility of doing so. Are you surprised that the Yankees have advised their shortstop, Derek Jeter, to, go ahead, test the market?
I'm stunned, actually. Jeter wants 6 years and $150 million, which no sane person would give him. And it looks like the Yankee fans are beginning to wonder about him himself, and I think Brian Cashman's playing this absolutely correctly. If you don't think our offer's fair, go see if you can get a better one.
Terry Collins last managed in the big leagues in 1999, but that did not deter the New York Mets from hiring him. Good choice?
I have no idea. I don't remember what his teams played like. I mean, I know he was at the Astros. He was 10 games over .500. He spent a year managing in Japan, and he actually was the manager of China when it won the World Baseball Classic in 2009. Can this guy handle the rapidly deteriorating New York Mets franchise? I don't know if anyone can, but at least this guy, if things go really bad, can retreat to other languages.
Charlie, it is perhaps old news, but on Sunday, when Jimmy Johnson finished first in the chase for the Sprint Cup, he had done that thing 5 consecutive times, so I suppose a salute to him from Mr. NASCAR would be in order.
I like the fact that he won it by winning the race. That was a very stylish move, and yeah, this puts him in very rarefied company.
When the Colorado Rapids beat FC Dallas on Sunday night to win Major League Soccer's championship, the two teams set a record for smallest TV audience for an MLS final. How bad is this news for the league?
I admire you, Bill, for actually throwing this into our little conversation. What really alarms me, and if I were a soccer fan, would make me have a very big sad, is the fact that they got an 0.1 and only 232,000 viewers on the Spanish language network Galavision, which I would suspect has a far more sophisticated television audience than that of the United States.
Yeah. Finally, Charlie, we have both heard a lot of unlikely stories about the people great athletes have credited as their role models and their mentors. But were you surprised when Kobe Bryant said this week that he was mentored by Michael Jackson?
Shocked, actually. And I guess I admire him for the depth and loyalty of his friendship. But my Lord, did the Lakers know about this?
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America, among other books. He joins me each week on Only a Game, of course. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Constant but never ascendant, unconcerned with macho posturing, all the while secreting its fingerprints across popular culture. That's how Roger Bennett and Eli Horowitz characterize ping pong, the subject of their new book, Everything You Know is Pong, How Mighty Table Tennis Shapes Our World. The authors have gathered, perhaps crouching as if preparing to receive serve, at NPR's New York Bureau. Roger Bennett, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having us, Bill.
And Eli Horowitz, welcome to you as well.
It's a thrill to be here.
Roger, how did it first occur to either or both of you that all the world could be explored, if not entirely explained, by means of ping pong?
Eli and I share many things in common. He lives in San Francisco, I live in New York, and the thing that bonded us was that separately to begin with, but then once we met, we started to collect ping pong ephemera, flotsam and jetsam, thrown off by the game since really the 1890s onwards. And the more we collected, the more we realized that the ping pong was really like a secreted DNA that was, when kind of furled together, could tell many of the mighty stories which shape our world. We were able to code together the stories about the rise of the great American suburb in the 1950s, China's unstoppable rise, all the way through to Atari and their invention of the video games, without which our lives would be meaningless. Ping pong was at the center of them all.
Well, we will get to some of these extremely important matters eventually. But first, Eli, can you explain, please, the theory put forth in Chapter 5 that playing ping pong reverses the aging process?
It's a multi-step thing. There are a few ways of looking at it. One is it's promoting brain activity, and there's been a lot of neurological research even doing MRIs before and after playing ping pong, and it's actually showing that's increased blood flow, increased brain plasticity, all these things. As a result of ping pong, it was in this Japanese journal, Biomekanazu, and there's graphs and data and everything. It's peer-reviewed.
Well, it has graphs and data and everything, so who can argue with it?
Yeah, we would accept nothing less.
Roger, you established the connection between ping pong and politics immediately in this book with a reference to ping pong diplomacy back in 1971. You write, and I'm quoting now, "Nixon's corpse began rotting decades before his death, and Kissinger will soon face eternal justice." Any worries that you might lose some readers very early on?
I think we'll probably gain them, to be honest, when you read out that quote so beautifully. And the ping pong diplomacy was a remarkable period. China is not a natural lover of ping pong, but the whole thing was a fabricated and rather cunning plan by Chairman Mao, who realized that China needed a sport to become world champion at in the 50s, and he was fishing around for what that could be. And he realized that the Holocaust had put a dent to the traditional champions of the game. In the 1930s and 40s, they were all Jewish, Austro-Hungarian mostly. Across the country in the early 50s, he sent ambassadors to every kindergarten across China, 12,000 of them, made kids test their reflexes with coins on the old elbow. Those that could catch them were whisked away to 14 ping pong academies he'd set up across the country. And within 5 years, the Chinese went from a country who had no real interest in the game to becoming world champions with Rong Guotong. And they've never really looked back.
No less remarkable is the assertion, and again I'm quoting, that ping pong is usually at the forefront of any fundamental shift in human experience, be it technological, political, or romantic. You want to buttress that proposition?
For example, with technological, we look at video games. The very first video game was in 1958 at the Brookhaven National Laboratory.
Where they had nothing else to do.
They had very little to do, and they were just trying to pass some time, and it ended up being basically a ping pong game. Unfortunately, they called it Tennis for Two, and so it was very unpopular. It was dismantled 2 years later. Then for the next 10 years, video game developers tried all these other games, space games, boxing games, hunting games. No one wanted to play them. It was only in 1971 with the creation of Pong that people were willing to reapproach video games, to take the leap to this new kind of entertainment, and it was because they married the cold technology of video games to the warm beating heart of ping pong. Even now they're doing experiments, this is for real, where people can control computers directly from their brain, quadriplegics and so forth, and the game they've used to test this new development is Pong and ping pong.
You know, I can say from experience that it is safer to play the video game Pong when drunk than it is to play ping pong when drunk.
Bill, that's a story that needs to be told. But again, it was one of the joys of this book, one of the stories that we uncovered in collecting the materials, particularly the advertising materials from the 1940s, late 40s, early 50s, the architects and engineers and real estate developers who were unfurling mile after mile of great American suburb. They had a marketing challenge. They didn't know how to coax people out of the city, in that they couldn't show the actual houses they were building because all they were cookie-cutter houses. And they almost, to an ad, realized that what they could sell to the American city dweller was the one thing that he and she didn't have in the city, which was space. And what bespoke space more than the basement? And what showed good times in the old basement than the American family rallying together in that basement around the ping pong table? And we have a chapter which was we gathered over 500 images that were very, very similar. It's always the kids, Bobby and Sally, whacking the ball backwards and forwards, beating good old dad, who was completely confused by the game, while mum came in her apron to serve up some muffins, looking very, very jolly. Mm. And right there, the great American suburban family myth is coaxed, and it's all forged in ping pong.
How is it that nobody previously discovered how central ping pong has been to progress of all kinds?
I think the key to that is that ping pong has never been kind of marketed and commodified the way all the other big sports have been. TV was never able to shine the spotlight on it, and so it could flourish in all these different ways, grow up in this diverse, heterogeneous way in all the different spots in the world. And so it didn't have that glare and that spotlight to pull all those strands together and to blandify it.
Blandify.
And that's why these blandify. And so instead it was all these little breadcrumbs, and we would just follow the breadcrumbs one by one and find these larger stories, you know, running all the way from the basement to the world championships, and it all kind of unites.
Roger, in the acknowledgement section of Everything You Know Is Pong, you, well, acknowledge that you no longer play the game. Why not?
Phil, this is a very, very emotional story.
You're going into dangerous territory here. Mm.
Ping pong was my life when I was growing up, like many fine young gentlemen growing up in 1980s Liverpool. I played often. I played very aggressively. It definitely brought out my violent side. And I got into a final, a city final. I played an opponent who I knew was lesser. But in the final, with everybody watching, I choked. Couldn't finish off my shots. They were all chipping into the net. And I had the out-of-body experience of just knowing I was going to lose. And I did what anybody would do in the early 80s in such a situation, what we've been taught to do by one John McEnroe. I lost with no self-respect, with no self-control. Bats were broken, balls were smashed, half the table was turned over. And I walked over to my family, sobbing. My father just looked at me and he told me, "You've just disgraced the family name." Not by losing, which is what I thought he meant originally, but by the way I lost. Mm. And I never, ever held a paddle again. I started collecting almost immediately. And to me, this collection that we've amassed together, Eli and I, of ping pong ephemera, kind of grew out of that moment.
This book was commissioned originally by Roger's psychiatrist, actually. It's just been a way of him working through some of these issues, and I'm glad that you are enabling that process.
It's been very healing, Bill.
Roger Bennett and Eli Horowitz are the co-authors of Everything You Know Is Pong, How Mighty Table Tennis Shapes Our World. It's published by HarperCollins, and the authors joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Roger, thank you very much.
Bill, thank you for having us on.
And Eli, thank you as well.
It's been great.
Ping, pong, ping.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Jack Flagler is our intern. We had help this week from Paul Vikas. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Karen Given's Cullen Jones photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Everything You Know Is Pong author Roger Bennett.
If you only buy one ping pong book this year, you should consider making this the one.
Darn, it's too late. This year I've already purchased A Pong Runs Through It, Pong of the South, and All the King's Paddlers. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Support comes from LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And American Jewish World Service, supporting local solutions to global challenges at ajws.org. This is NPR.